Okay, we are recording. This is Jen Brown. It is July 25th, 2022. I'm in Corpus Christi, Texas, here at Coastal Grass, here to talk to Reese Hunt about Baffin Bay for the Baffin Bay Oral History Project. So to begin, do I have your permission to record?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Since this is an oral history, let's start from the beginning. Can you tell me more about your background and early life?
Okay, I was born in 1947. I started going to fish the lagoon when they still had a drawbridge for Corpus.
Yeah, stop. Okay, you were at, you were born in 1957 when they
47.
Still had, 47, when they still had the drawbridge.
Yes, and my dad started taking me fishing somewhere between 10 and 12 years of age. We had a boat and they went fishing, and he had a fishing history for the lagoon. And then him and some guys built a house in the Laguna Madre at marker 69A, which back then was about halfway to Baffin. And we fished there, well, until now. I've still fished the lagoon.
So, how did your dad get into fishing?
That's interesting. He came from Mahia, Texas, raised on a farm, and the military brought him here to Corpus Christi. There was an uncle and some family, and that's how I got into the fishing. A lot of the guys from World War II, somebody in, of course, they're all passed away now, but they had a PT boat, and they used to go down the Intercoastal Canal and fish off of the PT boat. So, and my dad had Harold Shockley, D.C. Smith, and my father, Jimmy Vineyard. I remember all of those guys that went down there and fished together for years and years until the National Seashore took away our fishing cabin and made it the National Seashore.
Oh, because it was on the...
Because the spoil bank ended up being in the boundary of the National Seashore.
Hmm. So then what? What did he do? Did you get a new
cabin? Oh, they just kept fishing and doing things, and I was older, school and college and boats and things like that.
Oh. Okay. Do you remember the first time you fished Baffin Bay?
That would have been, oh gosh. I remember fishing it with David McKee at the year. Mid-70s, probably. I went there with my father and stuff, but for myself personally, would have probably been around early 70s. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me more about what it's like to grow up here hunting? And did you hunt too and fishing?
Oh, yes.
And...
Well, most of the hunting, a lot of the hunting was done in the Lareda area for the bigger deer, and then in the hill country. Everything seemed to be more than plentiful compared to nowadays, especially the fish. It was nothing for us to go fishing and take for food cooking oil and potatoes, eggs and bacon. We caught all our fish and fried them and ate them. We would have work parties when I was in high school that one person would go out and fish and wade while the other ones worked on the cabin, the pier, and things like that. That was normally Jimmy Vineyard, and he used the topwater plugs and stuff back then. I think they were wooden. And a few plastics, and would work the sandbars that came off of the spoil islands and just wade around and fish. The water clarity back then, 99% of the time, was clear and pretty. Good grass and nice sandy bottoms.
So you grew up in Corpus?
Yes.
Yeah.
Graduated from Ray High School in 65. And then started working here after being a javelina. Kingsville, A&I. And then I had a boat and started fishing. I guess my first 30-inch trout was caught as in the place where you enter into the tide gauge bar. Had a hydro sport boat back then, and I had a fishing cabin on Twin Palms Island shared with David McKee.
So how did you get into that?
From my dad, and I always had a boat, and so I enjoyed fishing, and he fished, and then one of my bosses, I took him fishing, and actually ended up buying his part of the fishing cabin from Gary Dukes, who's passed away, who I introduced to the Baffin area and the lagoon, and he became quite the fisherman.
Well, what do you think makes Baffin Bay special?
The remoteness. Back then, when we started out, a big horsepower motor was 35 horse. There was not battery starts. They were just engines. They had distributors and plug wires. And if you weren't a fairly good mechanic, you couldn't go too far. Most of the engines wouldn't start the next morning after a heavy dew because of the wetness. And as the motors progressed and the boats, most of the boats we started out fishing were wooden boats. They weren't fiberglass. And I remember the innovation of the fiberglass boats coming into the market and how amazed they were and what they did. And then the motors got bigger and bigger, and now anybody can go buy a boat and jump in it and take off. And if they don't run aground, they can run to Baffin Bay in less than 30 minutes. Used to, that was almost a 3/4 of a day trip to get there.
Hmm. So, what does Baffin Bay mean to you?
Oh, it's a great place to fish. I mean, for instance, I had a job where I sold equipment, like the cabinet shops, and I got interested in selling the wooden boat builders, Monail nails, sandpaper, and sanders, and saws, and all of the things you build a boat with. And that's when the Vanois and the Mayaks were building wooden boats for commercial fishermen. And as I fished with my dad and his friends, I got to see all of this evolve over several years. The game warden game with the commercial fishing, the gill nets. At one time, there was, on the way to Baffin to fish, there was so many trout lines that ran basically almost from the ditch all the way to the shoreline. A lot of the boats had bandanas on the bow. So if you didn't find the gate to get between the trot lines, the machete would cut the trot line so you wouldn't get hooked in it. And we literally had one fly over the top of the boat. We were all fortunate. But it was quite an experience when you're going, I don't know, the boat's backed in 20, 30 miles an hour, and you see this flail of hooks come over the top of your head and everything, grabbing, jumping, jerking. But, as far as fishing there, I think the big lure of Baffin was the big trout. So that's quite an experience to catch a 30-inch trout, which I've done. I haven't done a fly rod yet. I don't know. Baffin became overrun with people with the evolution of the fast boats and the neat motors, and there was nothing special about it. If you could buy the boat, you could do the game. So, so many sacred areas and rocks and places. The worm rocks are very wonderful to fish around. The different flags used to, it was clear water and you could see the rocks. Calcuttas with black flags. The scaredness of running your boat through the bay and hitting something, messing your lower unit up, punching a hole in your boat, all of those things were available in your trip. So that was part of it. It's just a neat bay to fish. I mean, if you fish Corpus Bay, it seems like Corpus Bay, the water's bigger. It's a different shoreline area where Baffin is a smaller shoreline. It seems narrower. And anyway, I guess most of this stuff is the farther away you go, the better the fishing's supposed to be. So, and it's a nice name everybody remembers. And I guess that's part of the big part. All the Laguna Salada, and there's three or four different tributaries to it. Olazan, all of those areas. There's a few lakes that are easy to get to. That's all part of Baffin Bay fishing.
Can you talk about, so you mentioned the boats and the changes and more people starting to come. When did that happen?
That would have been, I guess, the early 80s when that started, where everything got better and better with the electronics on the engines. And some of my old buddies, I mean, we had Gale Motors and Evinrude, and eventually Johnson, Mercury's. But I guess that'd have been around the 80s when the boats, because I'm pretty sure that was the 80s, the fuel injections that they ended up entering with the motors, and now we've gone into the four-cycle engines that are as good as automobiles and cars. So all of those things, when you add them up, you have access to anything. Where used to, it was three quarters of a day to get to Baffin, and then you're gonna spend a night there, you're gonna come back. So it got like that. A lot of guys will go in the middle of the night, go in the day. I've made many, many trips at night to Baffin Bay in the dark. It's just a neat place to fish. Fishing there in the winter on some of the flats. I've caught over 10 30-inch trout on plugs, not fly rod. Now I'm a fly fisherman. In a norther, I think Cliff Webb was there that time and caught fish on that norther. And I can't remember the day. It was just a fantastic time. I actually took a grass farmer from Bay City, Texas there. That we did all of that. So it's a neat place to fish. Then we ran up with the brown tide. We've had two or three of those. Things change. Places that we thought were sacred for wade fishing are runways for shallow water fast boats now. The tunnel hole boats, I guess those were late 80s when they became popular on the market. Turned guys loose in 3 feet to 1 foot of water that they can run anywhere safely. So they started running the shoulders of the bay. The really pristine waiting areas became racetracks for shallow water boats. And it's still going on.
How many boats have you went through since started?
A Van Oy, a Whaler, a Hydra Sport, a Shallow Sport, and a Hell's Bay.
Wow. So when did you get into fly fishing?
30 years ago.
What got you into it?
Actually, it's real simple. Woody Thompson, Woody and I both grew up here. Both our dads had houses in the Laguna Madre. I didn't mention earlier about what a wonderful place this used to be to duck hunt. There would be literally clouds, black clouds of ducks. I got into it there in the duck hunting. Would you just ask, what was it?
Getting into fly fishing.
Oh, Woody introduced me to a Flip Pallet, Walker's K TV show. And I saw that show, and it got so easy to catch fish with a spinning rod. My wife got me into spinning rods from bait casters, and I had been sight casting for a long time, that the new challenge would have to be the fly rod. So I got the fly rod. I went to Austin, Texas, and got the equipment for me, and picked up some stuff for my buddies, and we all started that. I found a welder and had a poling platform put on my shallow sport boat, and ordered a pole out of Florida. Got some advice from Moonlighter and put it all together, and that's some of the most fun I ever had. Fly fishing and poling. And then there's a place past Baffin that's called The Hole, and The Gutter, and The Summer House, and Rocky Slough. All of those areas are unbelievable to fish in. And when you just barely move through that, it increases your chances to catch fish. So trout fishing, you kind of run into a school and you clean up. Or for sight casting though, and sight fishing, you got to see the fish before you ever cast. So the fly rod and the boats and all of that evolved, and eventually I bought a poling skiff, and it's just another way to catch a fish.
What do you like about it?
Oh, well, I guess you could say I'm a gadget guy, and there's a lot of gadgets with fly fishing. There's a lot of gadgets. The list is endless. So Cheryl and I have waded many, many, many flats. So that's my wife, Cheryl. And basically two lures and a bottle of water maybe. And away you go, nothing else. And sometimes we would take the hookouts to pull a hook out. Most of the time, no. We fish barbless hooks. We've done that for years. And we would just go walk around in the hole or pole around and catch fish. And a lot of times we would never even touch a fish. Some of my buddies said I couldn't catch a fish on a Tony Aceta Pet, which I had to modify because the hooks break on them. So I modified those. I even made bucktails with my fly tying gear, and bend the barbs down on the hooks, and you just grab the spoon and flip it, and there goes your fish. You never even pulled him out of the water, and just keep on fishing. So back when I fished with the guys at the 69A cabin, pretty much we would have a 48 quart igloo and fill about half full of fish, and it's like, well, we've caught enough fish. And we didn't fill the boat full of fish. You could do that easy. That's what all of the commercial fishermen did. But we just take what we wanted, take what we needed. We didn't do fish fries for the church. We just took enough fish for us and our families, and that was it. And so Cheryl and I, we just like, well, why mess with all of this? We just have fun catching them. So that was our biggest thing, is to see the fish, track the fish, catch a fish, and let it go. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me more about the commercial fishing? And, you know, you mentioned the trout lines, but,
oh, yes.
You know, what else was going on?
Well, they evolved they baited the trout lines at one time, and then they had the game wardens or something. I'm not real up on it because I wasn't into it. So most of the things was hearsay. Or you'd hear people talking around boat ramps where you put your boats in and out, the fish market. But I think they used to bait them, and then they used plastic. They ended up putting, I want to say, oleander leaves for lures. They did lots of different things on the trot lines, and then eventually they got rid of all the trot lines. And then the gill nets evolved. And that's when the guys were catching so many fish in the gill nets. I knew three or four gill netters. They weren't the big boys, but they did it, and I knew the guys that did it. And it made them quite a bit of money. Some of the guys would fish the bay, Corpus Christi Bay, and they would only fish, they used a big mesh, and they would only catch the big trout. And then they would run up and down with their ice chest on Ocean Drive in different restaurants and sell the pick of the bunch to the restaurants, and that's how they made their money. A lot of guys did that. And then I think it was the Vanoys and another group, the big families, they got into it pretty heavy. And basically, I have seen a 18-foot skiff level, completely level. There's not any place to sit. Everything, all you could see in the whole boat's fish. And those would pull into the fish markets continuously. And those guys knew what they were doing. They knew how to run their nets. At one time, they overtook our fishing cabin and used it as a base station to fish out of. They knew how to run the lagoon. They knew how to run the boats. At one time, it was so lucrative that terminal tackle became a wooden skiff with a motor on it. They could literally throw it away for the money that was in that boat. And that's why they took the risk. And I don't know if it was like cops and robbers. In the old days, it seemed to be glorified, some of the bandits, some of the cowboys. But the commercial fishermen, I guess, that was part of the mystique of doing all of that. And it was so far to run to Baffin Bay when there was so many fish in the lagoon that it was more accessible, closer, quicker, faster, easier. And so the gill nets, they cleaned the lagoon out pretty well. And eventually I would say that I think Jimmy Atkins was one of the founders of the CCA, which became, the Gulf Coast CCA, and then it became the CCA. So what was it again?
I was just asking about the commercial fishing.
Yeah. It was a big thing to get to the fish market to outrun the game wardens. Naturally, a lot of them got caught. There was a lot of stories here and there. Different things happened. They confiscated the boats and they go get another boat, another motor, more nets, and away they go again. So, but all of that's gone now.
Did you witness any of that in Baffin at your cabin? You said they took it over one time?
Took it over one time. We could only go on the weekends. They used it during the week. And it's nothing to break into a cabin. So you can't really lock it up. It's just a little wooden plywood house. So yeah, it was obvious. They drilled holes in the walls where they would lay on the bunk so they could look up if they heard a boat and see what was coming. So they would leave or go. And that went on for years. Yeah, that went on for quite a while.
Wow. So... the other thing I wanted to ask about is you mentioned the brown tide and the water clarity, but can you talk more about the changes you've seen to the bay over time?
Just the dirtiness. But the rocks don't seem to be as big and tall as they used to be, but they've been run over so many times it's ridiculous. So, and kind of it's like it became to be, to me, overcrowded. And I just, when I started sight fishing, there's some places that guys sight fish. And I got a couple, three spots. But normally, you get run over. So I started fishing in other areas that were more remote than Baffin used to be. Just to get away from those areas. And then that's where all the guides go. It's where all the people want to go. That's the famous Baffin Bay. So, when I met my wife, we've been married over 30 years now, That's the first place I took her, was the Baffin Bay. And she caught her 28-inch trout. She was a happy little gal. She was happy as she could be. So, and we fished that for several years together. And one of the things is, like I was talking about, was, well, I think it's Clayburg Point now. It used to have another name. That we used to wade fish and fish around there. And then, I don't know, a lot of the areas that we used to wade on sand now have muck on them. And it's like, I don't want to go walking in muck and mud. And so then the water clarity is not the way it used to be for me. So I'm sure there's some diehards that still do it and everything, but it just got to be most of the guys that are going would cut around the point. I don't know, they come down Kapura Pass and then they come past the Twin Palms Island and shoot around the corner. And those were some great flats that are gone now. I mean, it's a racetrack through there. And then on the opposite side of the bay, on the west shoreline, Pensacola, and all the big rocks and stuff in there, well, you might ought to be careful. You might get run over by a shallow water boat. And they all run down the edge of the shoreline. So nobody runs in the middle, the waves, the roughness or whatever, and it's not as cool as it is. And one thing, I guess, that, you know, the commercial fishermen took fish. But sometimes Chris Thompson and I played with some numbers, and we were astounded at the amount of fish that guides take out of the water. So somewhere way back down the line, 80s, maybe early 90s, there was a tax bill that came out. And they took away the advantage of owning a boat and writing it off against a company. So when this happened, people started hiring guides, which were 100% write-off. And boom, all of a sudden you have all these guys that want to be guides. And the first few guides were really great guys. And then it just multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. And I mean, there's guides everywhere. They'll get on a school of fish and they'll work that school between several people. And then I don't know if it disappears, it goes away, or they can't find it. But some of the great Billy Sheikha, Baffin Bay, was unbelievable trout fishermen. And you said Cliff and Doug Bird, all of those guys. But that all kind of, maybe it went away with age because we're all older. But then you got all these new, younger guys, and things just don't seem to be the same. So there's less traffic where I go and the way I fish now. So that's one of the reasons. That sight casting is different though. And Baffin, there's places to do it there, but there's other waters that are easier to do it in.
What did, do you remember the brown tides and those
yes.
changes?
Oh yes.
What was
my
that
favorite
like?
Color became orange. I have no idea. I tied orange flies, clouser, with orange deer and some feathers. Anyway, I caught a lot of fish in the brown tide, fly fishing and plug fishing. But yeah, that turned out pretty good for me. Who knows? I read so many different things here and there about it. I think they said a couple of biologists brought it down from the East Coast, which was kind of a joke, but they were up there and they had it. They've had the brown tide up there too. So these guys were working down here, but, it's an algae bloom. And of course, now that the King Ranch got into the big farming area, and, there's a little creek you pass over south of Rivera, there's a little bridge there. And to me, because I used to make several trips to the valley all the time, it's where it kind of started. And if you follow it and follow it and follow it, it just, I don't know if the fertilizer influx, I know they say it doesn't, but and then there's so many variables, there's so many cattle now, there's so much farming now, a lot more people now. And as we populate, I think we pollute, all of us, to some extent or another. So it just grows and grows. And it's been gone now for a long time. And knock on wood, hope it stays that way for a while. We've had the red tide, the brown tide, big freezes, bad freezes. The fish seem to always be able to come back. And but I mean, it's just something you have to deal with. It actually was so thick that it would build up inside the outboard motors and cause them to overheat and have massive heating problems. Other things came from that. I know that I took several motors apart and literally scraped the stuff out of the water jackets, cleaned the heads, and put the motors back together, and away we went. There was some chemical stuff that was supposed to work. One of my best buddies was a marine mechanic, and so we did a lot of stuff on that. But yeah, it was really hard on the inside of the motors, and I didn't really believe it until I took a few of them apart and found the calcification on the inside from the brown tide. And of course, those heating problems went away when the tide went away. So,
what were the freezes like?
I guess the one when I caught all of the big trout, the 30-inch trout, it was just real, real cold. It was in the low 30s, and it was drizzling. And believe it or not, Gary Dukes actually told me where to go. And we went to Hell's Half Acre, wade fishing in the cold, out of my cabin there on Twin Palms. And just, we caught a lot of beautiful fish, a lot of gorgeous fish. Out of all of those fish, I did not keep one. I returned all of them. So, I guess David McKee gets a credit for that. The catch and release programs that he pushed and worked on so hard. And I don't know, I had my one trout, and that's enough. The rest, you know, now I eat trout, but not the big ones. So I wouldn't do that. I guess David and I got on my shallow sport. So that was the early 80s freeze, I think 83 maybe, that we went through Baffin a little bit and then shot down the cut and went into the cut. And David got to where we would only slow the boat down and stop when he saw a fish that was over 30 inches. So, I don't know, we spent a whole day running around counting fish. I know he's got records on some of that. And then this last little freeze we had, it was unbelievable. This time I didn't see as many trout, lots of redfish and drum, and tons of turtles. And I don't know, I've seen turtles in the surf, I've never seen them in the lagoon. And some of the guys I fish with, oh yeah, they're there all the time. Well, they must be, because we found dozens of turtles after this last freeze.
And you were just fishing down there? The one in 2021?
Yeah, we went down there to fish after the freeze. See the damage. I've got some pictures where it's just acres of fish laying there dead. It's really sad.
It's crazy.
There's a reason they say for that. This year, in the 80s freeze, that the tugboats, and that's what the Intercoastal Canal is for. It takes fuel and gravel to the valley. That's our biggest main fuel source, and the barges. So the big props stir the water up, causes the fish to get colder or die. This time they thought that the fish were in the bottom of the ditch, which is the deepest water. And as the boats would go through, they would stir the silt up. Because we have a lot more silt now than we ever had before. There's places like Peachy's Pole that I fished barefooted on sand and grass. And the last time I went there, I think it was about 6 or 8 inches deep in muck. So the causeway, the growth of all this stuff, I don't know if it really caused it. But the causeway, I'll call a dam. And I think we should be like South Padre and have a water exchange with a bridge, but we don't. And I think that's part of the slow death of Laguna Madre. It's not the way it was when I was young. And there are days that are really nice for pretty clear water. They're few and far between. But I just went to the hole last week, and it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And I've been down there on windy days before, and it wasn't that bad. So, and the holes were I've noticed places that I went there 40, 45 years ago, they're not there anymore. They're gone. You can't get out of the boat. You'll sink up to your knees. So I don't know if this is a natural evolution or if it's something that happens over time.
What about, I can stop that. Okay, we're back. Where were we? I was going to ask you, have you noticed any changes to the crabs or the shrimp over time?
Well, no, I haven't. I still see them. I know they're there. No, I really can't answer that one. I don't fish with bait or shrimp. I haven't in a long time. I love to eat shrimp. I go to the bait stands and buy fresh shrimp, head them and eat them. I've taken them to the cabin for people to fish with, and then tried to serve them to them in the evening, and they wouldn't eat them because they said they're not eating shrimp, they're fishing shrimp. And so I would have myself a feast, and I would get all, that's my favorite food, by the way, except for lobster and shrimp. And so I would eat all the shrimp myself. But yes, I never got into being a croaker soaker. The bait was a neat deal there for a while my children were growing up, taking lots of kids fishing over the years. And we fished with lots of shrimp. I think they're still fine. I know there's a lot of boats around. There's a lot of shrimp to eat around. So I'm pretty sure that seems to be okay, I guess, which would indicate maybe about the muck and stuff. I don't know.
What is your most memorable experience in Baffin Bay?
Oh, wow. There's too many. One of them is to sit on the porch and watch the sun go down. That is an unbelievable thing for me. I'm big on sunsets. I like sunrises also. I guess my biggest deal was in that one winter when I caught those 10 trout. That was one super memorable day. Another one was I was in the hole, and it was 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was on a shallow sport, and I don't know what was going on, but we were there for over an hour, right on the edge, before to leave, and fish.
I'll stop it. You were saying you're down in the hole, telling a story.
Oh, and I had my first fly rod, and it was fish after fish after fish. They were all redfish, and they were all on a mission, and they were all going right past the boat. Literally, I was sitting on the boat with my fly rod in my lap, and I had a redfish swim between my legs. My wife was on the bow of the boat, and she caught fish until she got tired. And at one point, I had the fly rod, holding it in two hands, raised above my head, raised my knee, and I was going to break it in half over my knee. I never caught a fish that day. It was a horrible, terrible experience, but I don't give up very easy. So, yes, now it would be different now, but yes, my little sage rod, I was going to break it in two pieces. And before I did, I realized I paid too much for it. Anyway, that was a memorable time. Another time we were in the hole and we were waiting, and there was a famous fisherman, Lewis Peets, and we had started at five poles on the shallow sport poling, and we had got almost a 201 channel, which is miles, and we saw this girl in a pink bathing suit. Anyway, she was hollering at us and screaming at us, and I thought I had done something wrong, and I was not that close to her, but I could hear her. And anyway, my wife hears better than I did, and she jumped in the water and went over there to meet Patty. And by the time that I got the boat kind of anchored and started that way, Cheryl had caught her a 28-inch redfish. She was holding up in the air. So then I went back to get the camera. Anyway, we stood there with Patty and caught fish for, I don't know, I guess, I think it was a three-limit fish, and she had 15 fish on her stringer. And we were letting them go, and she was catching them. And I said, well, where are you going to go from here? And she said, well, you see those boats? I said, those boats? And she goes, yeah, they were way over there, almost back to the normal entrance to the hole. And I said, well, you want me to take you back over there? And she said, oh, that'd be nice. So we took her back over to the boats, and there was a bunch of guys there. There was three boats of fishermen. And that's when I really got to meet Lewis, because we waited there about 45 minutes, and he came walking back up. And that's when I met Lewis, and the next morning we took him fishing on my boat. And these redfish were laying everywhere in the flats. We're in ankle-deep water. And you would put your lure in front of them and just shake it and stand still and shake it and shake it and shake it. And then all of a sudden, they would either explode and leave, or they would grab the lure and you would catch a fish. And we did that until the sun got up pretty high. And then that was about the end of that trip. But yeah, I'll never forget that day and that afternoon, because I'd never done anything like that before. So,
okay, we're back. Yeah, other good fish stories you want to share?
I did. My biggest one. The redfish is not the big fish stories, I guess. They're pretty easy. They're pretty sweet. But they're a lot of fun. To me, the fun is to see the game and then go for it. So, the trout don't play that as well, but we're exploring some new areas now, and I've been working on it, and we found quite a few lunkers with the fly rods, but we've got a lot of honing to do on catching the bigger trout in the real shallow water. So we've been working on that quite a bit.
Some of the questions that we're asking everyone is, what do you think success looks like in terms of current efforts to restore Baffin Bay?
How are they trying to restore it?
Well, there's various work. They've been getting a lot of grants lately. There is this whole initiative between the Heart Research Institute and the Estuary Program to... it's called Bringing Baffin Back, but they're working on like the wastewater treatment and some of the other.
I don't know. It will never be what it was, because the worms don't grow anymore. And that's what made Baffin Bay, Baffin Bay, or at least it was probably fed by a great river. And the little worm rocks that grew up, by the way, we have plenty of those, that they used to come real close to the surface. Most of that stuff doesn't do that. The ones I know of, they've been walked on, they've been run into, but I don't think they're regrowing. They seem like, to me, I've never found one or seen one with a worm in it. So as far as that goes, the runoff and the pollution is all still there. Of course, we flood Nueces with fresh water. Baffin only gets runoff water. I don't know how that affects the Baffin Bay area. I would think if you could do boating lanes, maybe start, there's an organization called Flatsworthy that's working real good out of Rockport to try to help people learn a little boat etiquette. It's a complicated thing. I think that every person that gets a new boat ought to have somebody show him how to run the boat, how to navigate the boat in the lagoon. I've talked to many people that have got in a boat, left a boat ramp wide open. They see water, they're going to go, and they run aground and throw people out of the boat. People get hurt. They wreck boats. They don't have an idea. There's a channel there. They don't know what markers are. There's so many people that buy boats and they just take off, and there's a lot to it. I've talked to some of the dealerships. They don't have time to go and let someone teach a person what they're getting ready to get into. So they got their life jackets and their whistle and their fire extinguisher, and that's about as far as it goes. There's lots of pamphlets. I think those end up in the trash can or under the seat or in the glove box. There's a lot of safety rules and do's and don'ts. I know they're starting to work on the boating while intoxicated type stuff. So it'll be a long process. There's just a lot of people. We used to go down and maybe see a barge and maybe see five or six boats. And now you can go down and you can see five or six barges in a day. You can see boat after boat after boat after boat after boat, where sometimes there wouldn't be any boats. So over the years, it's a lot of population, a lot of adds to it. I don't know. So many of the things, the cabins and the floaters, I think those guys are doing everything they can with their sewage and the composting toilets and the trash pickups. They're all working on that, but you still got, I mean, used to you may have 20 boats and now you may have 200 in the same area. So I don't know. And then the Riviera area, all the houses in that area that are growing and building, and there again, there's your population coming on. So I don't know if you can ever restore what was there at one time. I don't know. I know, it's kind of like, you're making me sad. I like the fond memories. And yes, I've been out there in some very troubling times, and at night. I almost ran into a barge one night, that was quite eventful. I don't boat at night anymore. I alleviated that problem real quick. But it was the way he had the barge tied, and then he shined his lights in our eyes, so we were blinded. We were going down the side of it, but we didn't know he had another barge on the side of the barge. But it was halfway back, and I guess he turned the light off just before we hit it, and I was able to navigate and make a sharp, sharp, sharp left turn, boom, and we missed it. I mean, we were within literally hitting distance of that giant barge, and anyway, yeah, that was, and our little light against his light, you could forget it, and just before we hit it, he turned his light off, and then we were able to see his barge on the side. It had no lights on it because it's supposed to have a little light on the front, and then it had a light on the tag barge, but it was on the big barge. That's why it's going around the side of it. So anyway, but yeah, that I don't like to remember that one.
Scary. How do you think we can get younger generations to want to be stewards of Baffin Bay?
Oh, wow. I know there's a tremendous amount of children programs going on. You know, the way we did it was my dad taught me and all his buddies. And those guys packed it in and packed it out. We took our stuff and we did our we had our fun and did everything. And there's a lot of people that just aren't that way anymore. And I don't know. I know that kids love to fish. It's excitement. It's fun. But I would say through the learning processes and some of the things they put on. But it's just, you know, I don't fish the same way I used to. I guess because the bay did change. And so I didn't change with it, I guess. Or I decided I would change and do something else. So, yes, for me, I've seen so many crazy things I couldn't understand that people got so mad and they wanted to kill you and run over you with their boat. And I had to be over 1,000 yards away from this guy. I couldn't even see his... couldn't even see his eyes or his hair or his hat. And we went down and went into one of my spots, and this guy went nuts crazy running over us with his boat. So it's, I don't know how you get people out of that. There's, I don't know how you can be fishing and have a boat pull up within 100 yards of you or closer and start fishing and wanting to talk to you. It's, I guess it's a kind of a private thing that's not private. I don't know how you... how do you handle the public? I mean, stewards, I can see that, but, you know, I think the state's done what they can and the game wardens have done what they can, but just a lot of reckless people out there too.
Well, those are all the questions that I have, but do you want to add anything or tell me some more stories?
Oh, I should have been more prepared for this. I didn't make a list or anything. But just so many great years down there with I guess my father's generation and some of the people that introduced him to it and then me to it. And then on down the line, but things aren't that way anymore. So, I don't know. It's a fun, neat place to be. I know some of the great experiences is when David got a grant with Bo and Pablo, co-chair. That was some of the most fun. I had two boys, 10 and 12 or so, and they were running tests on Baffin. That to try to work on a fish count and something like that. And we got to where we're all going down there at the same time together and cooking food and making air kites and fishing and doing things together and helping each other with the boats and different things. So that was a lot of fun working on the cabin and building it and taking care of it. That was a lot of fun to that. Of course, nowadays with the new super boats, you can run out fish and turn right around and come back and stay at home and turn around and go do it the next day. And so that's the part of where the boats, and then they sell boats to any and everybody with no instruction. There's something that would, I don't know about the younger people, but the older people could probably use more stewarding than the younger ones. And so, for instance, there was a time I had some black clouds in my life, and I didn't go fishing for quite a while. I had taken a Mercury 150, and basically it was in a probably over 100 pieces or more. And I didn't go fishing for quite a few years, and one of my buddies from Houston called me, and we put the motor together and we went down there and we went fishing. And I think I just lost my story with Jerry, thinking about Jerry. That was memorable. I just lost my story.
What was that?
Putting the motor together.
Oh, yeah.
Before you went fishing.
I was going somewhere with that, but I think I just lost it. Yeah, I did.
That's okay.
That was a memorable story, though. Oh, gosh.
We can come back to it if you want.
Okay.
What else?
I don't know. I had my two boys and their friends. They were all little kids. And I had my boat, and we were sliding into the pier. And the shaft that goes to the gear case broke in two pieces. It was a factory defect. So it was pretty chilly. And we were in deep water. It was over my head. So here I had these four little kids and myself. So I had my shallow sport. And I got a rope and skivvied down and got in the water and started swimming and pulling the boat and swimming and swimming and swimming. And finally I got it where my toes could touch. And then I started pulling the boat. And eventually we got the boat up and then walked it down the spoil islands until we got back to the pier and tied it all up. And so, you know, how are we going to get these kids home on time? Because it was Sunday afternoon. And so I think I had a red shirt. And I got a red shirt. And I walked across the island. I walked out to the end of a pier. And every boat that came by, I would wave this red shirt. And eventually a really nice guy came by. I don't think he ever told me his name. And he assessed the situation, and I said, would you please take these kids in? And no, I won't tow you in. So he came around the island and picked us up, and he towed us all the way back, and I delivered all the kids to their house. But that was quite an experience that we had down there. They didn't have sea tow then. I think that's what they call the ones that tow you in. So another experience with that same Evinrude motor. Cheryl and I were in the hole, and the motor overheated. And so we're in the hole, and we're in shallow water, and we pushed the boat. Literally, we had to push it. It would spin up and take off, and within less than 2-3 minutes, the motor would overheat. So we pushed the boat all the way from the 201 channel to roll-offs. Pushed it. A step at a time. Pushed it. And when we got to roll-offs in the deep water, actually we thought, oh yeah, our problems are over, but the motor still overheated all the way back to the cabin. And that was quite a trip. Cheryl never said a word about it. It's something we just had to do to be able to get home. And you know, now it's a lot easier. You have insurance that'll pay to come pick you up and pull you out. And it's a different group of people that I don't know if they really treasure the outdoors as a treasure. It's more like the freeway, just to use. And somebody else is supposed to clean it up and pick it up like they do our highways. So I guess that gets down to your stewardship. But that's a complicated one.
How did you, when you were teaching your sons how to fish, did you teach them to fly fish and catch and release?
I have no idea what happened, but neither one of them fishes now. One of my sons fished for quite a while. Neither one of them have cared about fly fishing, though they all fish with rods and reels. But Alan has never cared about fishing, and Reese did for a while, and now he's into something else. And actually, that's the reason I sold out of my cabin. Is neither one of my kids cared about it. And that was one of the big reasons that I sold my cabin down there.
Well, do you have anything else you want to add?
I'm sure I will.
Well, about if so, you can call me up.
5 minutes after you leave, I will.
After I pack everything up.
Right. No, Jen, thank you very much. Okay. It was a pleasure.
Thanks.
I hope it helps somebody someday.
Hopefully.
All right.
Okay, we're back for a slightly second part. Because Reese remembered something, so this is an addendum to his oral history.
Oh, okay. We were talking about how to make Baffin Bay better. And one of the things was the mystique of the bay with the rocks and everything in it. And so as you had to learn it on your own, took forever and a lot of tough experiences with the rocks and the Baffin and the shallow waters. So I was fishing one time and I had a black period there for a while and I couldn't go. And so I didn't remember if you went on the right or the left of where I was. So I was with Cheryl and we were on a date fishing. I said, "You know, I don't know if you go to the right or the left of the Calcutta." And back then, the rocks were marked with long Calcutta poles with black flags on them. And so I said, "No, let's just sit here for a minute." And so we're sitting there and we're plugging, and all of a sudden, here comes a boat, and this is one of the things that's messed everything up. And here comes this guy in a boat. Whoa! Bam! And he hits a rock. Smash! Bang! Boom! Cheryl, we go on that side of the flag. And so I would have idled across, but I knew that sooner or later a boat was going to come and show me the way. And that guy was okay. But he destroyed a lot of stuff, I'm sure. And we went on our way fishing. So one of the things that happened after the Calcuttas, Gary Dukes introduced me to my first handheld GPS unit. So they came out with GPS units. So now, all of a sudden, all the guides have GPS. And they go around and pull up all the Calcuttas. Or they just happen to all fall over at the same time. So now there's no Calcuttas anymore because all of the rocks and the hazards are marked in their GPS units. So now we go forward maybe 10 years and I got a GPS and I'm looking at it. Well, all the rocks are marked on a map. So now all I have to do is just go wherever I want to go when I want to go. It's like, holy smokes. And then a younger generation, you brought that up earlier. So I have a customer that's a super guy and he's 45 years younger than I am. So that'd be younger generation. He's actually gone and bought from fishing guides tracks to load into his GPS to show him where to go. He's had guides take him in his boat to make tracks. Yes. And he's bought these special programs he's told me about that I have no use for. So there's the information is so easy to access and get. So there's going to be more and more and more traffic because as we had to go and learn, it took us longer, slower, easier. And now a reckless group can come in there with a $100,000 boat and do what maybe it took us 4 or 5 years to find that fishing hole. So, you know, that's it's another thing where the technology may not be the best thing for the bay. So, because anybody can buy a GPS unit and the rocks are marked in it. Oh, let's not forget Google Earth, which I'm using to find lakes. So, the satellite imagery is unbelievable now. So there we go.
So there's no mystique anymore.
Not really. When you think about it, that's what I meant about the outboard motors. If you weren't a mechanic, you didn't go very far because your motor wouldn't bring you back. And so, yeah, we learned a lot of stuff with those old motors and stuff. Where now they're just like automobiles. They're really nice. I have one. I have a little 70 Yamaha. Every time I get in and hit the key, it's like, vroom, this is just like my car. This is awesome. And away I go.
Nice.
So, all right.
Okay, is that it?
Thank you.